Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and I'm here today with co-host today, Russ Chianelli. And we've got a guest who's going to be talking about climate change, climate warming, and how do we modify our behavior and our expectations based upon the very clear indications that this planet, and the Southwest in particular, is going to get a lot warmer. So our guest today then is Greg Garfin. He's a PhD. He's an associate professor in the School of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Arizona, and he is the expert in this field. So Greg, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us before we get into what you do in this area of global warming and how to prepare for it, if we can, in the Southwest in particular, how did you get into your area of expertise? What made you become a scientist?
Yeah, it was quite an accident. Yeah, well, when I was growing up and in high school and so on, in the early 1970s, the environmental movement was taken off. There was the Sierra Club and all sorts of pollution issues and things like that. And just like any good citizen, I was going to save the world. And then I went through a rather circuitous path to getting to saving the world.
But you're still on track.
As far as I know.
Good.
You'll tell me if I'm on track, I'm sure. I also had an interest in the arts, and so I started off in a degree in ecology, and then I switched to fine arts, and then I dropped out of school to be a rock and roll star, and clearly was not successful at that. And so when it was time to go back to school, I thought I'd do something a little more practical than rock and roll star or
art. Can we get some of your old recordings?
Unfortunately, you probably could find those online. At any rate, when I went back to school, I had a couple of goals. One of them was that I had never studied a foreign language. And the other, again, was to try to do something practical. And I thought that practical thing, given my interest in the arts, would be cartography. So I went to a geography department, and while I was waiting a year to get into a computer cartography class, because that was before GIS, I was studying Chinese, and while I was waiting to get into this cartography class, I had a year of classes to take, and so I took various kinds of natural sciences, forestry and hydrology and things like that. And I took a class in climatology, and the guy who was teaching the class was doing research in China. And when he learned that I was able to speak Chinese, he said, "How would you like to go over to China and do a master's degree on looking at historic records from the Chinese civil service that go back hundreds and hundreds of years and look at what the past climate was like?" And I thought, great. If it gets me over to China, I'll do it.
That is actually a wonderful story.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is all these little pieces falling into place. And yeah, cartography and then, of course, having to write the Chinese symbols. I mean, there's a relationship there also.
Sure.
Right? So this is tremendous. You're lucky to have been able to fall into all those appropriate cracks.
So what was the answer about 1,000 years of Chinese climate?
Well, so here's the thing. He couldn't find funding for me to do that project. But in the meantime, I actually developed a healthy interest in climatology and in the climatology of the Asian monsoon, which has subsequently served me well to study the North American monsoon. At any rate, I ended up coming over here to the Southwest, to the University of Arizona, to use tree rings to reconstruct past climates, and that's what I worked on for my PhD.
So where did you grow up? Where are you from originally?
New York. Where else?
Oh, I'm from New York,
too. It could have been Wimbledon, for goodness sake.
Where in New York?
Long Island.
I was from Long Island, too.
I'm from Belmore.
Bay Shore.
Okay.
Wow.
Just down the road.
Snap. Well, anyway, look, we'll have a drink on this later on. But before we get on to the science and back to climatology and tree rings, which I've got an interest in because we collaborate with people out in Arizona. That's a world center for tree ring analysis.
Yeah.
Before we get into that, the rock and roll. Were you the drummer, the lead guitar, the singer?
Yeah, so I was the lead guitar and the songwriter. Singing, I don't know that you could call it singing.
You just mentioned, Greg, the whole concept of monsoon, and, you know, there are monsoons all around. I think a lot of our listeners, they use the term, but I'm not sure they understand what it means.
Yeah.
So why don't you explain how you can have a monsoon? Most people think India and monsoons.
Oh, yeah.
Ricky,
well, that's
Tiki,
the strongest Charby, one on Earth.
Rudyard Kipling and all that.
Yeah.
Tell us, what is a monsoon and why do we have them here?
Yeah. So the formal definition, although I don't know that anybody holds to that anymore, is a change in the wind direction by more than 135 degrees between winter and summer. So there's a summer monsoon and a winter monsoon, and it's really obvious over Asia because the landmass of the continent is so huge. So that's why they have the strongest monsoon. I mean, you can think of it in very simplistic terms, although, you know, any reasonable meteorologist would beat me over the head for saying this, but it's somewhat akin to having a very strong land and sea breeze kind of system. And in the summer, as the heat builds up over the continent, it creates low pressure and it draws air in from the ocean over the land. In the winter, it cools down, there's high pressure, and it goes back out over the ocean.
Nobody had ever explained that to me, and it makes perfect sense, because you'd know about this on a daily basis. You know, you go to the beach, the wind's coming in one direction, and in the evening, it goes the other way. But the whole concept of on a bigger scale.
Yeah.
Thank you for the definition.
But we tend to think of it in terms of the precipitation
that results from that, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right, because it's drawing in all that moisture in the summertime. And in fact, in North America, it may not be 135 degrees, but we get most of our storm systems in the winter coming across in the westerly wind belt in the mid-latitudes. And then in the summer, as the wind belt and the jet stream moves further to the north, we get this monsoon circulation. Again, you know, the continent helps to draw the moisture in, the contrast between land and sea, and we get the winds coming in from the south and the systems coming up from Mexico. Actually, if you don't mind, the center of the monsoon action is in Mexico. We're at the fringe here. We're at the northern fringe.
Well, we've had this year some pretty powerful weather systems coming in from, and that's to do with El Nino, perhaps, or not? That's what they talk about.
To some degree, yeah. And certainly that'll be what we see for the winter here.
We're supposed to have a strong El Nino coming in.
Oh,
right?
It's happening. It's happening now.
Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about what El Nino is?
Yeah, sure. So El Nino refers to a system of interactions between the Pacific Ocean and the overlying atmosphere. During a sort of normal period, the temperatures in the eastern and central Pacific Ocean tend to be cool, and the warm water is all the way over in the West Pacific, and it's wet over there in places like Indonesia and Thailand and so on. And when an El Nino episode occurs, the warm water moves to the central and eastern tropical Pacific Ocean. And if you think about it, warm water is going to evaporate more, so there's more transfer of moisture and energy into the atmosphere in the eastern and central Pacific. And that feeds moisture and energy to a lower latitude jet stream, the subtropical jet stream that comes across our region, and it also fuels tropical cyclones in the East Pacific, so we get some of that action as well, like that one that just happened, the hurricane by Mexico.
That was big. And that came all across Mexico and reached East Texas.
Yep.
You know, I mean, it had a deleterious effect on the Formula One race in Austin. I know that for a fact.
So these very strong El Niños, right? So I mentioned energy. They're strong enough, right? When you think about the size of the Pacific Ocean, it's huge. They're strong enough that the really strongest ones, so normally in the tropics, the winds go from east to west, the trade winds. During El Niño, they go from west to east. And that is strong enough that it actually changes the Earth's rotation. You can measure it. It's a very small fraction of a second, but it's measurable.
Wow.
Only during the really strong ones.
That's a lot of energy.
So that's a lot of energy.
Let's talk about your area of expertise, as I understand it. You're in a position to try to make predictions, all right, and discuss how in the Southwest in particular, that's your area of responsibility almost, with this global warming issue, that all the models and all the data that you have access to, I think, predict that we're in for 2, 3, 4, 5 degree change and warmer change in the weather patterns, or should I say in the climate, over the next 40, 50, 60 years.
Next century, basically.
So tell us where that data comes from and the predictions, and then what it is that you're really trying to tell the public and people who are interested in how we're supposed to cope with this. You know, because if it's going to happen, then we need to be prepared. In some fashion. We need to have some ideas of what's going to happen to the plains, or are we going to lose the capacity to have agriculture? All of these things. You're the expert, and so the floor is yours.
So we have various kinds of evidence of global climate change and its regional manifestations, and we have that from observations made over the land, at various levels in the atmosphere, from snow-covered surfaces in the ocean, and so on. We have theories that have been confirmed based on studies of atmospheric chemistry and the physics of the atmosphere. And then we have models to project the future, or to at least understand the sensitivity of various systems to future change. And then we have evidence of impact. So I'll go through those, and hopefully you won't fall asleep while I'm doing that.
No, but I think before we do that, let me just say you're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli, Greg Goffin from the University of Arizona. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Greg Goffin, University of Arizona, specialist in climate change. And as you were saying, Greg, you've got all this data.
Yeah.
It leads to a conclusion that we're going to have a pretty warm next, 50, 60, 100 years. How do we cope with that?
How do we cope with that? Yeah. So we know the mechanism for climate change, the greenhouse effect. And basically, we've got gases in the atmosphere that have the property of letting shortwave radiation, ultraviolet, come through from the sun. About half of that passes through. It warms the Earth's surface and then is re-radiated out towards space as long-wave or infrared radiation. Those same gases have the property of trapping long-wave radiation, and that's a good thing because without those gases, and without trapping long-wave radiation, that planet would be uninhabitably cold. The problem is that we've put so much more of those gases that include things like methane and CO2 and water vapor and nitrous oxides and so on. The problem is we've put so much more of those gases in the atmosphere that we're trapping more of the heat in the lower atmosphere. And along with that, because we're trapping more in the lower atmosphere, the upper atmosphere, the stratosphere, is cooling. And we have evidence of both those things. So we have local evidence of that through looking at temperature records from thermometers. So we can see globally and also here in the Southwest, the temperatures have been increasing by several degrees. Well, in my region, just a little to the west of here, a degree and a half Fahrenheit over the last century, a little more depending upon where you are, or a little less, again, depending upon what the local conditions are. We also have, of course, globally, evidence of things that co-occur with this warming, like reduction in sea ice and glaciers, increase in sea level rise, acidification of the ocean from the ocean absorbing some of that carbon dioxide, and so on. Here in the Southwest, we've seen increasing temperatures, We've seen also effects on snow from the increasing temperatures. So we've measured early snowmelt runoff. In fact, since the 1950s, snowmelt runoff, depending again on which mountain range you're in and so on, has been anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks earlier. And also a greater fraction of late winter and early spring precipitation falling as rain rather than snow at elevations lower than roughly 7,500 feet. We've also measured a statistically significant decrease in soil moisture in the region due to increased temperatures. And we've seen various other kinds of impacts. Probably the most dramatic one, or two very dramatic ones here in the Southwest. One is that there's been conifer forest mortality due to, again, greater stress on trees from the combination of drought and elevated temperature, and also the elevated temperatures allow insect pests like bark beetles to have a longer life cycle, and then they can have more larger and more synchronous attacks on those trees.
I mean, if I can interject there, yeah. There's also the issue that we had a policy when there were natural fires to try to put them out rather than let. So there was a man-made
component. That's just the tree mortality.
Right.
That's just trees dying while standing in place. And then there's the fire issue. And yes, fire suppression definitely contributed to the fuel load.
Okay, so what do we do about this? Because there are conclusions with respect to agriculture, with respect to potable water, population, et cetera. There's so many issues that we've got to deal with, regardless of the cause.
Yeah. So the projections for the future are for the region to get hotter, much hotter, with annual temperatures increasing on the order of, depending upon the time period, 4 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit by the middle of the century, and 7 to 9 or more degrees by the end of the century. That's annual average temperature. So just to give you an idea of what the difference is, El Paso's annual average temperature is about 65 degrees Fahrenheit. San Antonio is about 69 degrees Fahrenheit, and Laredo is about 74. So if these projections come true, then in 40 or so years, El Paso's temperatures will be a lot more like San Antonio's and so on. So you asked about what should we do. So there are two sides to what we should do. One side is reducing the root cause, the greenhouse gas emissions, and the other side is adapting to change. And again, regardless of whatever of the cause of the change, we can always be better prepared for natural disasters and for things that we know that have gone on for hundreds and thousands of years, like drought episodes and so on.
Let's take agriculture. A lot of us have a bone of contention. I mean, I go through Arizona. First time I went, and I started to smell, in the middle of the desert, oranges. And then, you know, about 20 miles later, there's these bloody great big forests of orange trees. Mm-hmm. You know, no water falls there. It's all irrigation. Alfalfa growth.
And also cattle eating everything.
All of this is going to have an end at some stage, I would think.
Well, yeah. So agriculture is, in the western U.S. and certainly in the southwest, the largest user of water. 79% of the water in the Southwest is used by agriculture, and most of it is irrigated agriculture. And that produces a lot of value, literally probably tens of billions of dollars in products that are important for all of us. And I think perhaps for the future, given the increasing temperatures and greater evaporation and so on, combined with we've got a rapidly growing region, more people demanding more water, that we could probably do things in agriculture maybe a little more efficiently, So a lot of the irrigation is done by flood irrigation. They do it now using laser-level fields so that they waste less water. But there are probably other kinds of technologies.
Well, we use pivots, too.
Well, yeah, sure.
Which is more efficient than just dumping the water, right?
That's correct.
But a center pivot,
when you are in an airplane, you often see these circles of irrigated land.
Right.
And so that's a mechanized sprinkler, basically.
Yes. But drip irrigation, is that just ridiculous for large-scale agriculture?
If you talk to the Israelis, they would tell you no. I mean, there are some issues. You have a greater buildup of salts with, and that's a huge issue for the Southwest.
With the pivots?
With drip irrigation. Yeah. So at any rate, so you probably would have to every few years or maybe once a year or something flood a field to try to remove some of those salts if you use drip irrigation.
Ah, interesting.
But we do have water hog crops, as you mentioned, like cotton and alfalfa. And we have now a growing industry of tree crops that use a lot of water.
And also salt-tolerant plants are being developed.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So there are probably many ways in which agriculture could be more efficient and use water less. There are also, in our water laws and policies, there are perverse incentives to use water, because if you don't use your full allotment, then you stand a chance of losing it. So maybe we could find ways that wouldn't put farmers at risk to losing any of their allotment if they didn't need to use all of it in a particular year.
I mean, that's interesting, because part of your responsibility, Greg, is sort of, if I can use this terminology, outreach.
Yeah.
Right? And so do you find that when you talk to farmers, you know, they're interested in maintaining their quality of life, and
they
tend to agree with this idea of not just using it, because if you don't use it this year, you won't be able to use it next year. I would think that they're about the best custodians of the land that we have, in theory.
Well, they're great custodians of the land. But so here's a solution that economists are very fond of, and it's the idea of developing water markets. And that would be very sensible, because in some years you might, like one of these El Nino years, there might be excess water that could then be put into another use, or put into an urban use, or when we go into one of these severe drought episodes, allowing folks in agriculture to sell water to cities would probably make sense.
Well, I mean, but that's fine if the source of the water is, say, from Wyoming and Colorado, and you're talking about selling it in Arizona. But if you're talking about subterranean water that's on private land, that opens up a very nasty sort of scenario.
That's true. So we have to be wise in our policies about how we manage.
And also desalinization. There are some very good desalinization techniques that will be used more in the future.
Yeah, and that's part of the very large portfolio of options, the toolkit, as I call it, that water managers have. That includes everything from greater conservation to treating and reusing effluent, desalination, possibly water markets, building new dams if it's necessary.
Right. I mean, we've talked on this program before with people involved with public policy and water, water supply. You know, and I've often wondered why we're not more like, say, in Mexico, where in Mexico you have a tap or a faucet, I think. The water comes out, but you don't drink that. You use that for everything else. Mm. But the gentleman comes around with his big carafons of water, and that's what you drink.
Yeah. Well,
seems to me totally sensible. But nobody wants to do it here, because they say, we don't want to be the first city in America where you can't drink the water coming out of the tap.
Well, maybe not out of the tap, but, you know, one of the things that you could do, so it would be expensive to develop a complete two-quality water system of pipes and so on. That would be expensive. And
well, I was thinking of just using the original one with gray water. And then when you want drinking water, that comes around for free.
Okay. So I'm going to go back to the idea that
I was talking about for a long time.
Yeah, we probably could. But it would be possible, as somebody pointed out to me a few years ago, We're expecting the population to double at some point. So why not make new development with that second quality set of pipes, and you can use it to irrigate your yard, and you can use it to flush waste down the toilet and so on. And then you can have your drinking water tap, and you can get the fresh potable water.
Is that getting support anywhere from developers?
Not that I'm aware of, but it seems like that would be a policy that we could put into place. We do have dual quality water pipes for treated effluent where they're not treating it to drinking water standards.
Right. Well, I think campus of the University of Texas at El Paso, we have a gray water irrigation system.
Right.
So it can be done.
And in Arizona, parks and golf courses use that treated effluent for irrigation.
Hey, we could go on and on. Yeah. Greg, we've come to the end of our allotted 28 minutes. All I'd like to say is I'd like to thank you very much for being here. You're very, how do I put this? You're very calm, and you're talking about this in a very nice fashion.
And what do we do about it?
And we're happy that you're out there talking to people, and I hope you have a lot of success in changing the way people think about water in the Southwest. But we've run out of time, so thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
Well, there you are, folks. That's everything you need to know about water in the Southwest. We're running out of it. It's going to get hotter. Get prepared. Think positively. And don't forget to listen to Science Studio next week also. Bye-bye.